Good evening. This is the KRFP Evening Report for Tuesday, April 5th, 2011. I'm Lee Robartis in the news tonight. Idaho Senate approves restrictive abortion bill and sends it on to the governor. Closed primary bill hits snag. Iodine-131 found in rainwater in several northwest cities, including in Boise. Moscow City Council hears from Idaho Transportation Department engineer on split megaloads that may head up US 95 through Moscow, and the city council delays ball field vote. And live in the studios of KRFP in Moscow, Idaho, I'm Lee Robartis, and this is the KRFP Evening Report. The Idaho Senate voted 54-14 today in favor of a bill that would ban abortions after 20 weeks of pregnancy. The bill, which has already been approved in the House, now goes to the desk of Governor C.L. Butch Otter. Most states that limit abortion set the limit at 24 weeks because that's the point where the U.S. Supreme Court has ruled a fetus can survive outside of the womb. A deputy attorney general has already issued a written opinion saying the proposed law is unconstitutional. Medical doctors are concerned that the law may require mothers to give birth to babies with rare diseases that would give them little chance of living outside the womb. The House State Affairs Committee voted today to hold the closed primary law for 24 hours to give committee members time to investigate questions about costs and other issues. The bill, which would allow parties to prevent anyone but registered party members from voting in their primaries, has already passed in the Senate. Republican Representative Brent Crane of Nampa said, "I think it is a fundamental shift in election policy, and I have some questions about this bill that I need answered before I can make a decision as to whether to advance this piece of legislation forward." Language in Senate Bill 1198 estimates it would cost the state $215,000 to make the change, and it would cost counties another $160,000. Much of that money would be for voter education. Under the bill, those who show up to vote in the May 2012 primary would be asked to declare voter affiliation. Those who chose not to affiliate or chose to affiliate with a small party not holding a primary would likely get a ballot with only the nonpartisan judicial races on it. The Idaho Republican Party won a lawsuit against the state this year, so requiring a closed primary system is now considered unconstitutional. Attorney Gary Allen is leading a coalition of independent voter groups in an appeal of the ruling by Federal District Judge B. Lynn Windmill. Allen told lawmakers there are other options besides closed primaries, including Washington's top two primary system or having parties hold conventions or caucuses at their own expense to determine nominees. Allen said, "We encourage you to adopt an option that allows independent participation. The Republican primary in Idaho often is the only election that counts." Research done by Boise State University recently found that for the first time in decades, Idaho has more independent voters than Republicans. The Boise State University Public Policy Survey results released this year show 37% of Idahoans consider themselves independents, 33% of Idahoans consider themselves Republicans, and 21% consider themselves Democrats. Democratic Representative Afreda Higgins of Garden City said, "I truly don't care if primaries are open or closed, but I really care about the cost to the taxpayers on registering political parties, on using the taxpayer money for political parties to get people registered for their party." Environmental Protection Agency tests have found traces of iodine-131 in drinking water in Boise and Richland, Washington. The amount is 0.2 picocuries per liter. which the EPA says is so small that an infant would have to drink 7,000 liters of water to receive the same dose as that of a day's worth of background radiation. Rainwater tested in cities around the Northwest contains larger amounts of iodine-131. The rainwater levels in Boise were the highest at 242 picocuries per liter. In Olympia, they were 125 picocuries per liter, and in Portland, they were 87 picocuries per liter. Those levels are several times higher than the EPA standards for iodine-131 in drinking water. The EPA says these standards were set to protect a person who drinks radioactive water for 70 years. Elevated radionuclide levels were found in rainwater in several states, including in the East. Rainwater in Boise, tested by the EPA, shows it contains trace amounts of radioactive cesium-134 and cesium-137, which has a longer half-life than iodine-131. Trace amounts of iodine-131 was also found in drinking water in Seattle and Idaho Falls. The ExxonMobil test megaload scheduled to leave the port of Lewiston last night at 10 p.m. was delayed at least 24 hours because of lack of permission from the state of Montana to travel on its highways. ExxonMobil subsidiary Imperial Oil wants to move the test load 7.5 miles into Montana and park it at Lolo Hot Springs until it receives further clearance to travel through Montana on its way to Alberta. Imperial Oil said the test load weighs 490,000 pounds, less than the 508,000 pounds originally announced earlier in the year, and considerably less than the 590,000 pounds the largest load bound for the Alberta tar sands over U.S. Highway 12 would weigh. Imperial Oil has yet to receive a Montana travel permit for any of the 114 loads it says it wants to move across the state. The Montana Department of Transportation says it will require Imperial Oil to build numerous turnouts along the megaloads Montana route so the loads can pull over and let traffic on two-lane highways pass them. So far, none of those turnouts have been built. Also, Missoula County and three environmental groups sued the Montana Transportation Department last week in an effort to block the megaloads because they say the department did not do a full environmental impact statement and did not consider the environmental impacts caused by 114 megaloads. The test module has similar dimensions to the ExxonMobil megaloads parked at the Port of Lewiston, but looks like a blue building on a giant trailer. There are two 10-foot-tall tanks connected to large pipes that go inside the building. There are doors on two sides of a garage door-sized entrance. Tourism business owner Linwood Lawhee of Kuski, who will be an intervener in the Idaho Transportation Department's contested case hearing over the megaloads later this month, told the Lewiston Tribune he doubts Imperial Oil's assertion that the megaload has no industrial value. Lawhee said, "They're buildings and they're very heavy buildings. There's something in there. They're not mock-ups." Imperial Oil spokesperson Pius Rollheiser told the Tribune the test load is large and heavy enough to prove the equipment can be moved over U.S. Highway 12, but the load won't serve any industrial purpose. Idaho Transportation Department spokesperson Adam Rush said in an email to the paper, "It's not working equipment. It looks the way it does to demonstrate what a module will look like and what its dimensions will be." Meanwhile, Imperial Oil CEO Bruce March told the Edmonton Journal that the oil giant will reconsider using already assembled modules from the Korean company Sungjin Geotech when expanding their production in the Alberta tar sands. March said, cost, quote, wasn't an enormous factor, unquote, in the company's decision to order the 207 fully built modules from Korea. He said Imperial could have ordered parts of the modules and assembled them in Edmonton. The already assembled units are 30 feet high, so they can't be transported from the coast on U.S. interstate highways or Canadian highways unless broken down. March said, "We could have gone either way." Imperial Oil is splitting the 33 megaloads at the Port of Lewiston into 66 smaller loads that it plans to ship through Moscow and Coeur d'Alene on their way to the Alberta tar sands. Those loads will be 15 feet 10 inches high, which is less than the typical maximum semi-trailer load. Most highway overpasses are at least 18 feet high. Two Montana activists say they are encouraged by CEO March's comments. Zach Porter of the Missoula-based All Against the Haul told the Missoulian newspaper, "It affirms our allegations and encourages us to persist with our campaigning." Sarah McMillan of the Western Environmental Law Center said, "Maybe they're rethinking it and determining the other way may be more straightforward than they had originally thought." The Moscow City Council heard from Idaho Transportation Department District 2 engineer Jim Carpenter about 45 minutes last night on ExxonMobil's proposal to ship 66 split megaloads through Moscow. Mayor Nancy Cheney said her chief concern was that there be an opportunity for public engagement over the issue.
I know that there's not a legal requirement to provide for this public input, but I think that there ought to be an ethical requirement to do so. I'm, it's troublesome to me that we have been out of the loop and really appear to, you know, our opinions as a community, as a local government, haven't seemed to have been considered in this case. And I'm very concerned about hauling these big loads through the core of town on a one-way street, you know, potentially for months or years to come. And it seems like what we don't know is probably a truthful but not a very reasonable answer for any of us. And I would hope that you could be informed by the oil company as well.
Mayor Cheney noted with some dismay she had just found out the split megaloads were coming through town on March 22nd. Jim Carpenter said he knew about it approximately a week before that. Carpenter said he has made a request for ExxonMobil officials to attend a public meeting along the route, but has not heard back yet. The loads will be 24 feet wide, meaning they will take up both lanes of US 95 on the sections where there are only two lanes. ExxonMobil says the largest load on US 95 will weigh 165,300 pounds, be 207 feet long, and be 15 feet 10 inches high. The company says it has split the megaloads that were originally slated to travel over US Highway 12 to Montana because of delays in getting travel permits for the Highway 12 route. Carpenter said the loads would travel at a maximum of 30 miles per hour on flat stretches of highway, but would travel about 12 miles per hour within the urbanized area near and within the city of Moscow. He said it would take each megaload between 13 and 20 minutes to travel through the Moscow area. He said only one of the loads would be on a section of highway at a time, meaning up to three would be traveling between Lewiston and Lookout Pass on Interstate 90 at any given time. Councilmember Tim Brown asked if there would be any extra policing services needed as the loads move through Moscow at about 2 a.m.
Do you anticipate the need for the local law enforcement officials to be on site at a heavier presence than they would normally be? And if so, what their duties and responsibilities would be as far as getting these megaloads through town?
Member Brown, I would anticipate that we'll have the same safety meetings that we held with the loads that went up from Conoco. which at those meetings we invited all the local law enforcement, included all of the local emergency services people. And they do those kind of a safety meeting so that they can kind of go over and explain what they're going to do and what their impact would be in their area. Mm-hmm. I don't think there'll be probably a need for increased awareness for that. The carrier is required to do all their own traffic control. So they'll be setting up flagging stations, pilot cars. It's up to them to have the advanced vehicles out in front of it to get that done.
If there's an increased cost to the to a city for providing additional policing services, how are the cities compensated for that?
We didn't have any requests from the counties or the cities when we went up through on US 12, but certainly when we do our safety meeting, the carrier would be responsible for paying the price, to cover that cost, just as they pay for Idaho State Police to be with that. If the city of Moscow was called upon to help in some way with their city police department, they'd certainly be paid for those costs. At this point, their traffic control plan they don't think they'll need that.
That was Idaho Transportation Department District 2 Engineer Jim Carpenter answering a question from City Council Member Tim Brown at last night's City Council meeting. When pressed by Mayor Cheney, Carpenter said he expects there would be between 2 and 5 days advance notice for the law enforcement meeting. Cheney said she had heard from a Transportation Department staff member that the loads could come through Moscow as early as Monday, April 18th, but Carpenter said he had no information on when the travel plans and permitting process would be completed. Councilmember Dan Karskalin asked if ExxonMobil had considered using U.S. 195 through Washington to transport the loads instead. Here's Jim Carpenter's reply.
I don't know if they've approached Washington DOT. It would be a longer route to run 195, and then they'd have to take the interstate through Spokane area, which might be more problematic for them due to much higher traffic volumes. As you'd mentioned, all of the hills like Marsh Hill and Crooks Hill and Steakhouse Hill, we do have three-lane sections with six-foot shoulders, which would accommodate the load going up through and allowing traffic to pass through those areas. So even though they will be going slower, about 10 miles an hour or so to go up those grades in Walk County line. And then the second day they'd have the 7 hours that they'd be then running up to I-90.
Jim Carpenter of the Idaho Transportation Department. City Council Member Tom Lamar was concerned about the rest of the 207 loads ExxonMobil said they want to ship to the Alberta tar sands.
I mean, I don't know if they're all going to be cut in half, but if they are, does that mean that we're going to have another 340 come through after the 30, or after the 60 that we're going to get? So that would be a total of 400?
They don't have plans to do that. And so then they haven't shared plans with us to cut more in half or to do those kinds of load reductions with it. Their plan is still to propose to run loads on US 12 after these are moved up US 95.
That was ITD Region 2 Engineer Jim Carpenter answering a question from Moscow City Council Member Tom Lamar at last night's City Council meeting. You're listening to the KRFP Evening Report on KRFP Moscow. The Moscow City Council last night decided to indefinitely put off an $8.7 million plan to build ball fields on city-owned land on West Palouse River Drive. Councilmember Walter Steed said the main problem with the West Palouse River Drive plan is the location. Here's some comments on the issue from three city council members, first Walter Steed, then Tom Lamar, and then Wayne Krause.
A large number of the children of Moscow live on the opposite corner of town, and that there was no good way to get them through town and across town and out Palouse River Drive. And the $7.8 million price tag on this project reflects that, because without having you go back to the slide, a large part of that $7.8 million is infrastructure just to get there and to build a bridge to an adjacent property that, according to what we would do to a developer developing this property, would make him do. I don't think it's practical for the city of Moscow to just build ball fields on the Palouse River Drive property and not improve the street, build sidewalks, build bike lanes, build street lights, and all the other things that we need to make it safe to get children, their parents, carpooling, and all that stuff out there. I just don't think that that property in the foreseeable future has a future for a ball, as a ball field.
I believe that the motion on the table allows us an opportunity to work on existing potential fields that are close into the town, that are closer to residential areas in Moscow, and allow us to take care of those, what I believe to be low-hanging fruit first, perhaps even less expensive fruit, and take care of those things. I think that sometime in the future, the proposed Palouse River ball fields probably will be developed as parkland and ball fields, but I think it makes more sense for us to move forward on some of these other places first, so I intend to support this effort.
I just don't want it to go out that this that the ball fields are just gone completely. That it's just, it's not dead, it's just asleep for a while, and as the mayor has said, one day this property will be developed. Whether it's ball fields, that'll be something to be determined down the road.
That was Moscow City Councilmember Wayne Krause, preceded by Tom Lamar and Walter Steed, also members of the council. City Parks and Recreation Director Dwight Curtis warned that location problems would affect alternate ball field sites as well.
Low-hanging fruits were already looked at, and I promise you that you will have many of the same issues come up when we get to them, other than Joseph Street. That was always our first option, and it was just, the door was just always closed, and we were unable to open it. Seems like that's cracked a little bit now, and a little more possibility, but just about anywhere else on the edge of town is going to have the same infrastructure issues, not to mention the less available of effluent if it was the stand of the councils not to use city water.
Moscow Parks and Recreation Director Dwight Curtis. The city council could still put the ball field bonds election on the ballot in November, but council members don't consider that likely because of the current economic downturn. The National Park Service, the Montana Department of Livestock, and several native tribes are expected to finalize a plan this week for a bison conservation area in the Gardiner Basin north of Yellowstone Park. State, federal, and tribal officials hope the plan, which will let bison roam in an area outside the park where few ranchers operate, will end the two-decade-old conflict that has led to the slaughter of thousands of bison who have migrated outside of the park boundary in the last decade in search of lower elevation winter forage. Ranchers have backed the Department of Livestock's decision to slaughter bison over the years because the animals could spread the disease brucellosis to their cattle. Brucellosis makes female cattle abort their young. Montana State Veterinarian Marty Zalewski said in order for the plan to work, increased bison hunting will have to be allowed in the Gardiner Basin. Zalewski says 450 bison need to be removed from the Yellowstone herd in order to prevent the state-sanctioned bison slaughters from occurring again. Cyclists in Yellowstone National Park will largely have the roads to themselves until April 17th. The West Yellowstone News reports this part of the year is when roads in the park are closed to regular traffic as plows clear snow off them. Cyclists are currently allowed on several roads in the northern part of the park, including the route from Mammoth Hot Springs to the west entrance via Madison Junction, where snow plows and the occasional work crew are the only motorized vehicles on the roads. Washington House leaders yesterday released a proposed two-year state budget that includes $4.4 billion in cuts, the privatization of liquor distribution, and the retainment of some services for the poor and disabled. Washington lawmakers face a $5 billion budget gap in the 2011 to 2013 biennial cycle. The current fiscal year, which ends in June, also includes a leftover $1.2 billion deficit. The proposal from the Democrat-led House cuts almost $485 million from higher education. Legislative leaders said the cut of nearly a half billion dollars would be offset by increased tuition. Tuition for big universities such as the University of Washington, Washington State University, and Western Washington University in Bellingham would be raised 13%, while tuition for smaller colleges and community colleges would be raised 11%. The cut to higher education is higher than initially proposed by Governor Chris Gregoire in her December budget proposal. The privatization of state liquor distribution proposed in the budget would bring in $300 million in one-time revenue. The state would establish a competitive bidding process to find a private distribution company who would then pay the estimated $300 million to the state. The proposal would keep in place services such as health care for the poor and disabled. House Ways and Means Committee Vice Chair Jeannie Darniel of Tacoma said, "There were some things we were unwilling to do, like eliminating the only safety net available for the poorest people who are unable to work and care for themselves." Democratic leaders said they want to vote on the proposed Washington House budget plan Friday and say they have the 50 votes to pass it. However, Republicans are more doubtful that this proposal will be the final House budget plan. Republican Representative Gary Alexander of Olympia said, "I've seen some go-home budgets before, and this isn't one of them. I've got a go-home budget that reduces spending by about $1 billion more than the Democratic proposal." Alexander said he will propose his new budget plan tomorrow. Governor Gregoire, however, said she is pleased with the current proposal. This year, the Washington House is proposing its budget first. The Senate will propose their budget later this month. Whitman County switched over to its financial software to a system called New World yesterday. Nearly 6 years after the county purchased it, the initial payment and subsequent updates for the software and the county's three-year-old server amounts to an estimated $430,000. However, Whitman County officials hope the software will eventually save money and lead the county through economic uncertainty. Well, that's it for the KRFP evening report for tonight. Take you a look at the weather from the National Weather Service. There's still a flood warning in effect for Whitman and Latah counties. A slight chance of rain showers before midnight tonight, then rain and snow showers likely between midnight and 2 a.m., then snow showers likely later. Mostly cloudy, otherwise low 33, southwest winds 10 to 20, gusting up to 30, 80% chance of precipitation, and new accumulation of less than 1 inch of snow possible tonight. Tomorrow, 80% chance of snow showers before noon, then rain and snow showers in the afternoon, high near 42. Southeast winds 15 to 25 miles per hour, becoming west. New snow accumulation less than 1 inch possible. Wednesday night, 50% chance of rain and snow showers before midnight, then a chance of snow showers, mostly cloudy, low 28. New snow accumulation less than 1 inch possible. And Thursday, 50% chance of snow showers, mostly cloudy, high 44. New snow accumulation less than 1 inch possible. Or excuse me, less than half an inch possible. Currently light rain, 43 degrees in Moscow. Thanks for tuning in to the KRFP Evening Report. Remember, if you want to help KRFP keep news reports like this on the air, plus the news reports you hear during Morning Mix and the public affairs, programming, and local events you hear broadcast throughout the day at KRFP, you can become a member of Radio Free Moscow. It costs $35 a year, $25 for students. You can mail your memberships to 114 East 3rd Street, Moscow, Idaho, 83843. That's Radio Free Moscow's address. Or go to the Radio Free Moscow website to find out how to become a member and donate to Radio Free Moscow. RadioFreeMoscow.com, KRFP.org. I'm Lee Robartis. Ryan Phil assists with tonight's newscast. Coming up, Change Surfer Radio, followed by Flashpoints, the daily investigative news magazine from Pacifica Radio. And then Fiddlin' Al's back in the studio about 7:40 tonight. Stay tuned for more. This is KRFP Moscow.